8:45 this morning, Aaron Hernandez arrested by police, led away from his North Attleboro, Massachusetts home in handcuffs, taken by police cruiser for processing. 90 minutes later, the New England Patriots cut him from their roster. This afternoon, still wearing his white T-shirt and gym shorts, Hernandez arraigned on a charge of first-degree murder.
So the future on the football field was very bright for Aaron Hernandez, but he's had a troubled existence. Gang activity reported when he grew up in Bristol, Connecticut. He's been accused now in Florida of shooting a friend of his who was in the car in his arm. It traveled to his face. It took out his eye. A $100,000 lawsuit has been refiled.
Surprising that
yesterday.
That story didn't surface until all of this came out, isn't it?
It looks as though his friend was covering up and protecting him, and now he wants money. But the guy's making $40 million, and he's only suing him for $100,000, so that doesn't add up either.
That doesn't add up at all.
And he wouldn't identify him to the police in Florida. He was in the hospital for 2 weeks and said he didn't know who it was who shot him. So on the field, he's been excellent. Off the field, he also admitted to marijuana use. That's why he slipped considerably in the 2010 draft. I talked to a couple of player personnel directors who said they really didn't want any part of him. That's why he went in the fourth round.
Hello and welcome to The Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And just apologies, I have a very heavy head cold and virus at the moment, so I'm sorry if I'm sounding a little bit nasal or my thoughts aren't coming and connecting with my mouth quite so quickly. So apologies in advance.
Better. Well, she as usual, fantastic. I can see her on my monitor, but anyway, she may be sick. And I am Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. I also have a cold, but we're going to push through.
So, Lauren, Lisa, this Wednesday, episode 5 of Criminal Minds, season 15, will be airing, and it was written by me and my friend Bobby Chacon, his first ever writing credit. So
that's right.
Shout out
that's
to right. Bobby. And
excellent.
It's my last episode of Criminal Minds. It's actually...
What a way to go out, Jim, though.
It's a great,
When I read that script, I was like, how are they going to do this?
It worked out well, though. I mean, yeah. Tanya McKiernan, who was our director, she used to be a stunt person. So she got it. And it just worked out so well. She was so good at laying out this massive fight scene and the shootout and... Oh, it was so great. And all our guys are in it, and our female heroes come in, and it's just so cool. It really worked out well. So we're really excited about it, and I hope everybody enjoys it, and I certainly will. And I will certainly always remember my 15 years at Criminal Minds.
Absolutely.
What a ride.
Absolutely.
It's a long time. A long time for a show. From beginning to end, for it to keep coming back. So congratulations to both of you. I'm sure it does feel like a big end of an era.
And thank you, Lisa, for the casting in that episode. There was some really excellent actors.
Okay.
So I just hope that everybody enjoys it as much as we did in putting it together.
Yeah.
You have to put more out on Twitterverse. I know lots of people who listen to RCP also. When I'm tweeting Criminal Minds, love to hear little bits more. So yeah, fantastic. Thank you both very much for giving us Criminal Minds for so long, and Erica Messer and all the rest of the incredible cast and Criminal Minds family. I've certainly enjoyed being there at times and being in the writer's room, and what a great energy and fantastic show where it's educated so many people. That's a really important part of it.
Yeah, I think we probably were the first crime show to ever say coercive control and to do episodes about male sexual victimization and episodes about the real nitty gritty of what happens in a child abduction. I mean, there's so many things that we were privileged to be able to educate the public on while we were entertaining them.
Episode 12, season 12, Coercive Control. And there those who haven't seen it, please do. Because I think it was the first time that we've seen something in a scripted show about coercive control. And funnily enough, just to let you both know, there's a soap called Coronation Street in the UK who are currently doing a coercive control storyline. Mm-hmm. But Criminal Minds was first, and that was great. It was great working with you on that, Jim. And yeah, that's huge. It's a big deal.
I know. And I was happy to do it. The thing is, I miss my Criminal Minds family. It really was. I mean, a lot of people probably say stuff like that, but we worked so well together as a team, you know, in the writer's room, all of our casting, our crew, all the producers, we all had a great relationship, and we had just a really special decade and a half. Mm-hmm. And I think the actors who portrayed myself and my colleagues at the Behavioral Analysis Unit did an exceptional job, and they were so happy together, and I think it spread out. Came down from Erica Messer.
She set the tone. Yeah.
Yeah. She was calm. She was so caring. She was so efficient and so competent at her job. She did it so well. We never had a problem. Never. Mm-hmm. It was so good. And even when, you know, the ultimate emergencies happen and things go wrong or whatever, she just dealt with them so well. Mm-hmm. And everybody else just felt good about it because she did. Mm-hmm. So what a great boss to have. And
what always impressed me about her was when I came to the table read, she would always go round, shake everybody's hands, ask who they were, explain who she was, and she knew everyone's names. Even when you were shooting, I'd watch her, she knew everybody's name. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything that she didn't know, and she was very hands-on, but not in a micromanaging way. And I was always very impressed by that.
Yeah. But you know, when she did that, she'd go around the table and she'd say, "Hi, I'm Erica." And she actually didn't say, "I'm the showrunner." You know, she didn't. And I'd have to run around before she would get to each person and go, "See that nice lady coming? She's our boss. So, you know, she's not going to tell you that." But, you know.
Right. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. She was not at all looking for credit. She was just a very lovely human being. And I was so happy to work with her.
So what's next? What's next after Criminal Minds? What are you both working on at the moment? Anything you can tell our listeners?
Sure. I'm working on a show called Crime Farm. And Janine Sherman-Barois, who was the head writer at Criminal Minds for a number of years and also a great boss, she's the showrunner on it, along with Claws and a couple other shows that she's running. And this is going to be one of the first shows on HBO Max.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Yeah.
And so it's a really complicated crime investigation story that has so much character. It's not procedural at all, but it has a lot of very twisty, turny, moving parts that make it really fascinating. What's great about it is we're writing all the episodes, all 10 episodes, before we even start shooting.
Wow.
So we get to really see the entire season as a whole and then put some even better plot twists all through it. So I really love that process. And it's a real benefit being able to have that overview while you're writing.
Cool. As far as what am I working on, I'm working on a pilot for FX. And I can't say anything more than that. It's with a very cool writer, director. I will tell you, he's nominated for an Oscar this year. So that's a little clue right there.
Wow.
But I'm working on it. It's an amazing pilot. I really hope it goes forward. But it's been quite a journey. And I'm working on a movie with Joe Mantegna. Oh. Joe Mantegna is directing a movie that's about the time that Frank Sinatra's son was kidnapped.
Oh, geez.
This is back in the 60s.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah,
or whenever it was. So Frank Jr. was kidnapped by three bumbling knuckleheads, and he was recovered. And so it's the movie about that. So yeah, so
sounds good.
You've been busy. What about you, Laura?
Lisa. Probably some of our listeners know I've been doing My Two Cents, which I've been covering the Weinstein trial in detail and forensically deconstructing what's going on at court every day, because I feel very strongly about poor me syndrome and. Yeah. Hit the walkers being used and ill-fitting suits and every tactic being played by the defense, even using two men who are about 6'5" to stand either side of him as he hobbled into court the other day to make him look small. I mean, he's over 6 foot himself, but he momentarily forgot that he was using his walker, and he picked up one of his hands and started waving it around and then realized the paparazzi were all there, so quickly put his hand back on the walker. So yes, I've been deconstructing Weinstein. There's a lot going on every day at court. And I'm also working on an animated true crime documentary. And it being animated, it's the first time something like this has ever been put together. And I'm working with a brilliant team, an all-female team out of New York. It's called Jennifer 42, and we're making progress with it. And it's a very important story, which I'm really looking forward to telling. And Jennifer's daughter, the children, are actually talking us through the whole narrative, so it will be voiced by them.
Is it a children's story?
It's an everybody's story, but because it's animated, it's accessible to everybody. And it's beautifully hand-drawn by a female animator who's from Belarus, Yulia. So I think it's much more accessible to people seeing things in animated form. And the hope is that it will be shown in schools, because we do have to talk about healthy relationships.
Right.
And what and that looks like.
And unhealthy ones.
Yeah, and unhealthy ones, because right now people don't know. And Jennifer's children are very brave. They're adults now, and I don't want to say what the end is, but it's a very twisty, turny, true crime case, and it happened in Connecticut. And the family are also supporting the coercive control law. We've just had it tabled in New York, but there's also a law now that's been tabled in Connecticut, and I'm in talks with other legislators all across the U.S., But the children, I've been spending time with Jessica, the eldest daughter. She's really amazing, and she wants to advocate on her mother's behalf and make sure that changes happen and that people aren't put in dangerous situations where if they stay, they die, and if they leave, they die. And this really is a story of success to a degree, and then what happens thereafter. But like I said, it's very twisty-turny, and I've certainly never seen anything like it before, and I was really pleased that the team approached me and asked me to help produce it. So
sounds great.
You'll be hearing more about that. And I'm also doing a lot of training. So I'm just gearing up for my UK tour, where I'll be stood in the classroom training on stalking. We just had some new stalking protection orders come in the UK. So I wrote a piece for The Telegraph about those orders and that pieces of paper don't protect people. And I'll be training on coercive control and the dash. And various other training programs as well. So a busy time, but I have got a little trip before that, going back to the UK to see family. As some know that my mother, the Marge, hasn't been very well and has cancer. So I'll be going back and spending a little bit of time with family, but as well, I'll be continuing my two cents about the Weinstein case. I think this is not just about a moment, the Me Too movement. Actually, Jim, it's going to be very interesting to see whether any law changes happen as a result of this case, because I do think there is some very interesting discussions to be had about how much information is in the public domain before a trial happens. Like in the UK, for example, and Australia, you can't hold press conferences and you can't put certain information in the public domain the minute somebody is charged. It's sub judice. And I think if anything, because there are documentaries, there are books, there's so much that's been published about this case, I followed the jury selection process very carefully. Over 2,000 people, majority of whom said that they couldn't not be prejudicial or biased against Harvey Weinstein. And they were honest in saying that.
Right.
I wonder whether there may be some further legal discussions, whatever the outcome is of this case, whatever it might be. And I have to say, it's not open and shut by any means. Once you understand that it's two women, a number of charges, five charges, but it relates to two women. It's not 80 women. And once you understand the burden of proof, of course, it has to be proved beyond reasonable doubt, that the case is not simple and it's not a foregone conclusion, even at this stage in proceedings.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because this is something that I think really started with OJ, where the defense lawyers use the public media as a strategy during the build up to the trial and during the trial itself, and they did it effectively, and so other lawyers follow suit. It's also an amazing way for them to advertise their services, and it's something that I think we should be discussing when we discuss how Jose Baez entered the Aaron Hernandez case. And and the results of that. So I think that'll all come into our discussions of the killer inside the mind of Aaron Hernandez.
So Hernandez being charged with the first-degree murder of 27-year-old Odin Lloyd, along with five gun-related charges, which include carrying a firearm without a license, possession of a large-capacity firearm, possession of a firearm without a firearm owner's identification card, and two additional firearm charges.
So my son asked me today, what are we going to be talking about on the podcast? And I was so conflicted on how to describe it. We're going to be talking about the murder of Odin Lloyd and several other victims. But I also said, well, we're going to be talking about a guy who had everything in the world at his fingertips, and he just could not blow up his own life. He could not stay away from violence. And I guess we're going to be talking about is not so much a whodunit, but a whydunit.
It's an inside the mind of. But I have to say, it's one of our sponsors from the Netflix show, the Aaron Hernandez case and show. And people know it by Aaron Hernandez and not by the victims. I knew his name, but I didn't know the victims' names. And in fact, even with Odin Lloyd, there's very little out there about him, and there's very little about the other victims too.
Oh yeah.
And I think that part is really shocking, that they haven't received any real attention, even in the documentary, which jumped around a lot. Even for me, not knowing very much about it, it did seem to jump around a lot. But there were other cases where he was suspected of shooting other men. And so I'd like to talk about that as well. Of course, he did take his own life.
Right.
So he is no longer alive to answer for those other crimes that he was being reinvestigated for. But what did you know about it, Jim?
Well, I did know about the two murder trials totaling three victims. And I know that he was convicted of the first one and sentenced to life without parole. And then he was acquitted of the second one. And then shortly thereafter, he killed himself. And it seemed very bizarre. I didn't know a lot of the background. And I know at the time that they were talking about CTE, and that's chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And that is something that we've seen in a number of violent deaths related to football players. And that some of those deaths are suicides, some of those deaths are murder suicides, and some of those deaths are murders. It seems that there's a connection there, and I think we should all get into how much we really know about that or how much is theory. But it was just so bizarre to even think about that in a 23-year-old young man versus where we usually see it, which is in long-retired older men who had spent an entire career, peewees, high school, college, and then pro athletes for, you know, a dozen years. They typically were found to have it. And as far as I know, he is the youngest case in history to be diagnosed with CTE.
Yeah. Well, he was also the youngest player to be in the NFL on an active roster. So maybe that contributed to it too, that he was so young.
Yeah.
I'm sure it did, but he was playing from the age of eight, tackle football. I mean, we don't have the, like in the UK, we have rugby and we have other contact sports, but I have to say that football, this American football seems much more violent. It's a game that seems to be built on violence. And I'm very curious by the fact with CTE, because I had to look into it myself, but when you get a concussion in normal everyday life, of course that's a problem. And of course you deal with it seriously if you're concussed. And I find it quite amazing that people wouldn't think that constant contact and tackling and trauma to the brain is not going to have an impact, particularly over a sustained period of time. If this guy was doing this from the age of eight,
right? And we all know
it would have an impact.
Yeah, we all know that there are different parts of the brain that control that, like, they're your internal policeman, or woman, and they control your behavior. They give you the ability to sort of discern, oh, that's not a really good idea. I shouldn't do that. And when we see people with major frontal lobe injuries, we typically see that they can be very impulsive and they can act on things that normal people wouldn't act on. So, but I also think there has to be a basis for it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you get a frontal lobe injury and then you're changing into a person who has these horrible thoughts and acts on those thoughts. I think those thoughts are more a part of the person preceding the injury, and that's why they act on them. But we can get into all this in detail. But this is a very incredibly complicated situation, both emotionally, behaviorally, legally, and with this aspect, medically as well. And there's so many different things going on. I thought it was fascinating. And I'm glad it was only three episodes because there was so much in that time. I think we could talk for episodes and episodes about this particular documentary series. It has so many very divergent aspects to it. So we should talk about it.
There is. And like with everything, I think behaviorally, when we look at things in terms of any case, it's important just to say it's never one thing on its own. There's never one thing in isolation. But I do think that this particular case, there is a perfect storm of so many things coming together.
Oh my God, you just read my mind. I just was saying it's a perfect storm. It was like a perfect cocktail that led to these murders almost.
Yeah, I really think that there was. And we can talk through what those factors are. For me, I always start with childhood, you know, what was going on mm-hmm. in the person's childhood. And again, it doesn't excuse anything, but it explains things. And just, we will get into CTE, but I do think it's very interesting that other people, in particular, when you've got Dr. McKee, who is the leading expert and looked at Hernandez's brain, if you're looking at 330 brains and none of them killed anybody else, then we know straight from, for me, that it's not just the pathology on its own that's answerable for the behavior. Mm-hmm. But when we peel, it's like an onion there, you've got to peel it back and understand what's going on behind the curtain. And childhood does tell us a lot. And here, and it's not to excuse, I do want to make that point, but his father, Dennis, was, and yeah. I've heard it described in so many ways, people say volatile, he was authoritarian, he was a disciplinarian. Well, I'm making it very clear, he was abusive and he was violent.
Oh, absolutely.
And he was physically violent and emotionally abusive and controlling.
Right. Well,
that was a perfect storm in his childhood.
Right. And what's amazing, Laura, is that how they told this story in the documentary, like you both said before, this documentary jumps around a little bit. And when they come back to the issue of his father, it's when his father passed away when Aaron Hernandez was 16. And at that time, they said he was the man who put order in his life. He was the man who showed him how to be a man, who was going to be there to be his foundation, who was going to be there to teach him how to be a good father. And I'm like, hello, did you forget what you told us before? Did you forget that the man was an alcoholic, that the man was abusive to him, that he treated him horribly, that what he was going to, I don't know how to say this, but he's going to beat the gay out of him.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's the man whose loss created this problem? No.
But there's this duality. But right in the beginning of Aaron Hernandez's life, he has this duality where he has a father who is exalted as the king in the community. And it's a disciplinarian, all these positive things. Yet the other flip side is he's fucking beating his wife's head against the sink. So he's right from the beginning, he sees that people can be have two different lives, have two different faces, right?
Aaron, he's beating Aaron too.
He was very charming as well. These monsters hide in plain sight. And so to have these characteristics being described as he's charming, he's gregarious, but he was a disciplinarian. He taught those boys discipline. Well, what was also known in the community was that Dennis went too far, in inverted commas. And he didn't just go too far. This is child abuse. This is domestic violence. This is something being dressed up as something else. And I do think, Lisa, that whole, he's the king in football, you know, somehow And I was very sporty and I was always very good at sport. You can get a free pass on things. And I don't think that that's right. You can shine and you can be good at what you do, but you cannot excuse, and we're going to come back to this when we talk about it in more Florida. Detail, the behavior. This guy was beating his children, and the older brother, Jonathan, was terrified to the point, and so was Aaron, but to the point that he threatened to call the police. And then Dennis said that if he did that, he would beat him so hard that the cops would have trouble pulling him off of him. And so every time he went to call the police, he didn't. And I could just imagine how terrifying it was for those two boys, seeing their mother being beaten in front of them. And Aaron and Jonathan were appearing at school with black eyes, with bruises on them. And yet nobody says anything and nobody does anything.
Mr. Hernandez appears to regularly place himself in situations where there are firearms, after-hours clubs, and aggressive behavior, and that no good will ever come of the combination of those three.
What's also important is Aaron Hernandez, when he came onto the scene in terms of the football career, the professional football career, and the $40 million contract, he presented as this sort of urban, tough guy, thug who made it into the NFL. But when you peel back that onion you were talking about, Laura, he grew up in a nice suburban neighborhood. Yeah. None of that. Absolutely none of that. That was all something that he chose to bring on in his own life.
And to be powerful.
Right.
To be powerful.
To appear powerful, right? And to tattoo his body so he'd look menacing. And it's interesting, the juxtaposition of, they said when he came into court, one of the potential jurors just gasps, "Oh my God, he's beautiful," or whatever, something like that. He's a good-looking, handsome guy. But then he gets all these tattoos to try to make him look so tough. And that might be to cover up what his sexuality was. And so it reinforces that duality you were talking about, Lisa. There's a definite issue when this guy, who actually grew up in a nice home with an abusive father and a mother who apparently was being abused and perhaps not able to protect her kids, this guy, the way to compensate for that was to pretend he was a thug, pretend that he grew up in this tough neighborhood with all these vices around him that unfortunately poor people end up growing up around.
Yeah, I mean, it's very sad because in one sense, because he obviously did feel worthless and felt a great sense of shame. And I think that looking back at what he's then done is to overcompensate. Then at 19, he's posing with guns, and Brian Murphy, his agent, actually said to him, Aaron, you're going to sign this big contract with the NFL, and what you do on the pitch and off the pitch is where you earn your respect. And he turned around, he said, "No, you don't get respect from that. You get respect from this." And he showed him a gun. And we do know people go into gangs to feel like they belong, to feel like they have a sense of identity and to counter those feelings. And again, it's not an excuse, but we do have to look at the impact of domestic violence and the domestic abuse on children. And they are the forgotten victims. And then when you add in the fact that he was sexually abused by somebody else who he and his brother didn't name, then that adds so much more confusion, conflict, shame, judgment, blame, feelings of worthlessness, that even at that stage, the fact he's not talking about it and hasn't got an outlet to talk to someone, he's externally, he's posturing in a way that, he's a kid desperate and crying out to be helped. That's what I see, just red flag after red flag after red flag. And now this isn't excusing what he goes on to do, because some of those things are choice made and choice derived, because he wanted to feel powerful. And we just do not pick up domestic violence. And I've listened to so many people describe this case and describe Dennis still in a very positive way. And we have to change this codified language. I really am fed up of hearing volatile, turbulent, tumultuous. disciplinarian, authoritarian. We're just codifying child abuse.
Abusive, criminal, asshole. That's what he was. I mean, he wasn't a
bully,
good father.
Yeah.
You can't be a good father and do those things.
You cannot. That's exactly right.
You can present to the community that you're a good person, but you're not actually being a good father. You're not providing your family and your children with a good foundation if you're smashing your wife's head in the sink and you're beating your sons into a tremendous fear of you. So
all the while, though, Jim, telling them that this is what a real man does. I mean, that was the conversation the whole time, particularly when Aaron Hernandez turned around and said he wanted to be a cheerleader. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, it's the silencing, it's the suppression, it's the shame. He wanted to be a cheerleader because his cousins were cheerleaders. I mean, to his father, this was an affront, you know, this masculine, as he saw himself, this real alpha male. And I do believe he was beating the shit out of his kids to install in upon them that this is what a real man does. Well, that ain't no real man to me. And this is where I think, you know, for young people, we really do need men to stand up and show what a real man looks like. And it's certainly not being abusive.
No, I mean, he smashed his wife's head into the sink until she was unconscious. It's brutality. It's a crime. He should have been in jail for a decade as a result of that.
But it's normalized, right? That's just family life.
Yeah. No one stepped in.
He's described as wild. His father was wild. What does that mean? It's just terrible.
Well, there were drills constantly to remind them and, you know, doing 100 press-ups, sit-ups, and just these really harsh punishments. And that had a profound impact on Aaron. And that's why his brother, Jonathan, you know, wrote the book and said that no one had any idea what was really going on for him and Aaron behind closed doors. And that's where we've got to make these conversations much more acceptable. This isn't about teaching kids respect or discipline. This is beating the living daylights out of them and in plain sight and nobody doing anything. And so this sets the ground, all this confusion, all this conflict and the sexual abuse as well, which I know, Jim, you can talk to, but very conflicting for a young boy. And then he's being told this is what a real man looks like. I mean, this is just a melting pot of potential disaster.
Absolutely. And when you sort of marry that with his sexual activity, I mean, I thought it was interesting. His friend, Dennis, who described Aaron as just this wonderful, bubbly kid who had a smile on his face all the time. And you could see this is Dennis's personality. And he's sort of projecting the same thing on Aaron. And maybe Aaron was like that to him. And, you know, he said he made fun of himself, Aaron Hernandez did. He didn't pick on the smaller kids. And that is an important thing because there's a lot of big guys who, when they're looking for power, will stomp on little guys. So at least from Dennis's perspective, that didn't happen. But I do think that Dennis might have painted the whole picture with a little bit of a loving brush that may not have been totally accurate.
Well, Dennis could have been equally the protective factor, though. Mm. When we've been abused or when we're being abused, having someone who's empathetic and having someone who sees the good in you can bring out the best in you. And I believe they did have a deep connection. But I agree with you. Seeing his face beaming and this kind of cheeky, lopsided grin, they seem to have this real bond and it seemed to be a very positive influence. But then when they are away from each other, of course, there's other people who have an influence on him. And I would imagine that Hernandez was easily influenced and easily led. He was very talented, but he got very quickly, he could understand that he was talented and he could get a pass for anything. Mm-hmm. And that will have a very negative impact as well when people are saying yes and clearing up after you and you're never held to account for anything. Again, it's another recipe for disaster, not having clear boundaries and being told no when you're young and super talented.
Right. And the just one more thing on that. I think the arc of Dennis and his father, I thought they did a great job in that series.
And that's fascinating,
Yeah, like you didn't realize that he's sitting there with his dad there the whole time. And then when they pull back and you see the dad in the picture, And then you hear about their interactions. But and the dad was really interesting. And there's a lot of things I want to talk about, because the dad did perpetuate a lot of those myths about Aaron's father, about how a man should be, and about how Aaron legitimately reacted to things that happened in his life. And I don't believe that. I think he's wrong about that. I appraise him for being able to sort of rise above and accept his son and deal with his sexuality in a way that he certainly didn't do before. And so that's a good thing. But I didn't like the fact that he basically tried to rationalize how Aaron reacted when his father died, when his mother moved on to somebody else. And yes, that's a very difficult situation, but does it justify the things? And this is, I wanted to ask you about this, Laura, and you too, Lisa, just the whole issue with his mother, with Aaron's mother. I mean, how blatantly he disrespected her and threw it in her face and then physically threatened her as if it were nothing.
You mean from behind bars? You mean on the phone call? He's saying, if I were in front of you right now, I would punch
you. I would beat the shit out of you. I was just amazed at how blatantly violent and threatening his language was to his mother on a recorded line from prison. If I were with you right now, I would beat the shit out of you, or something to that nature. But then on the flip side of that, their discussion where she said, if you could just give me $1 million,
yeah,
then I'll be set for life.
No.
And it was interesting, his response to that. You know, it's not like I have millions of dollars. What are you talking about? That kind of thing. But why would I want to do that for you when you never were a good mother to me, basically, is what he's saying. Like, I told you things in confidence and you told everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I test you all the time. This is the kind of relationship he has with women. I can't imagine that he isn't replicating that with his girlfriend and baby's mother.
Well, that's exactly it, Jim. The cycle continued on because the police were called multiple times to their home address and to Hermosa Beach. There were domestic violence call-outs. No surprise there.
No surprise to me.
The cycle continues. He's witnessing his mother being beaten and by his father. His father is the, and I hate even saying it, the man of the house, and his rule goes. That's what he was brought up with. And therefore, he doesn't respect his mother. And of course, the emotional bond gets interrupted when that happens as well. Everything in your psychosocial development gets interrupted, and sexual development, because of the fact he was sexually molested. But I do think with mom, there were other further complications. And she was running various criminal scams,
right,
betting scams, and she declared bankruptcy. And it was not a stable home in any way. No. It was abusive and violent. The father, Dennis, absolutely terrified and terrorized all of them. And his law went. So, of course, Hernandez Jr.'s struggle with everything. They struggle in their interactions and they've got nobody intervening. He does start to have a close relationship with Tanya, the cousin, once his father dies. But I do think by that time, a lot of the damage had been done. I would imagine that his mother was asking for money too. And therefore, you've got his frustration that he feels people are sponging off him and using him. And as he said in prison, and it sounds like he did have some come to Jesus moments, there were over 300 phone calls that were recorded, that he did have time to think a lot about things. And he realized that his mother wasn't the mother that he needed her to be. But right, it's very difficult to be that mother when you are being abused and terrorized and terrified. And it goes back to my point again, and I'll make it very plain, that women get held accountable for men's violence, in the sense that even now there are child protection conferences going on all across the country, not just in the US, but in the UK, where it's the mothers who are victims of domestic abuse being sat there with safeguarding professionals. And every professional is loading up that woman with all these things that need to change in order to protect and safeguard the child. And the perpetrator is left without any sanctions at all. And people think that that is going to change the situation, loading up a woman who is being controlled and terrified and terrorized. And then when they can't protect their child, they blame the mother. And I can say, because I've sat at these conferences and I've been the voice of many women who cannot be their own voice at that time. They don't have agency or autonomy. And I do feel very strongly about this, that we need to talk about male violence and the impact that it has on everybody in a household.
Wow, we have so much more to discuss about this incredibly engaging documentary series. It's only 3 episodes, but there was so much packed into it. We have tons more to say about the victims, about the ripple effects to the family members, and about how society really should respond to this kind of a situation in the future. Till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.